February 7th, 2003. Hi, friends and family and others. I've been in Palestine for 2 weeks and 1 hour now, and I still have very few words to describe what I see. It is most difficult for me to think about what's going on here when I sit down to write back to the United States. Something about the virtual portal into luxury. I don't know if many of the children here have ever existed without tank shell holes in their walls and the towers of an occupying army surveying them constantly from the near horizons. I think, although I'm not entirely sure, that even the smallest of these children understand that life is not like this everywhere. An 8-year-old was shot and killed by an Israeli tank 2 days before I got here, and many of the children murmur his name to me, Ali, or point at the posters of him on the walls. The children also love to get me to practice my limited Arabic by asking me, Kif Sharon, Kif Bush, and they laugh when I say, Bush Majnoon, Sharon Majnoon, back in my limited Arabic. How is Sharon? How is Bush? Bush is crazy. Sharon is crazy. Of course, this isn't quite what I believe, and some of the adults who have the English correct me. Bush, Mish Majnoon. Bush is a businessman. Today I tried to learn to say, Bush is a tool, but I don't think it translated quite right. But anyway, there are 8-year-olds here much more aware of the workings of the global power structure than I was just a few years ago.
Nevertheless, no amount of reading, attendance at conferences, documentary viewing, and word of mouth could have prepared me for the reality of the situation here. You just can't imagine it unless you see it, and even then you are always well aware that your experience of it is not at all a reality. What with the difficulties the Israeli army would face if they shot an unarmed U.S. citizen, and with the fact that I have money to buy water when the army destroys wells, and the fact, of course, that I have the option of leaving. Nobody in my family has been shot driving in their car by a rocket launcher from a tower at the end of a major street in my hometown. I have a home. I am allowed to go see the ocean. When I leave for school or work, I can be relatively certain that there will not be a heavily armed soldier waiting halfway between Mud Bay and downtown Olympia at a checkpoint with the power to decide whether I can go about my business and whether I can get home again when I'm done. As an afterthought to all this rambling, I am in Rafah, a city of about 140,000 people, approximately 60% of whom are refugees. Many of whom are twice or three times refugees.
Today, as I walk on top of the rubble where homes once stood, Egyptian soldiers call to me from the other side of the border, go, go, because a tank was coming. And then waving, and what's your name? Something disturbing about this friendly curiosity. It reminds me of how much, to some degree, we are all kids, curious about other kids. Egyptian kids shouting at strange women wandering into the path of tanks. Palestinian kids shot from the tanks when they peek out from behind walls to see what's going on. International kids standing in front of tanks with banners. Israeli kids in the tanks anonymously, occasionally shouting and also occasionally waving. Many forced to be here. Many just aggressive, shooting into the houses as we wander away. I've been having trouble accessing news about the outside world here, but I hear an escalation of war on Iraq is inevitable. There is a great deal of concern here about the reoccupation of Gaza. Gaza is reoccupied every day to various extents, but I think the fear is that the tanks will enter all the streets and remain here instead of entering some of the streets and then withdrawing after some hours or days to observe and shoot from the edges of communities. If people aren't already thinking about the consequences of this war for the people of the entire region, then I hope you will start. My love to everyone. My love to my mom. My love to Smooch. My love to Fig and Barm Hair and Sesame's and Lincoln School. My love to Olympia. Rachel.
February 8th, 2003. I get a number of very thoughtful responses to the email I sent out last night, most of which I don't have time to respond to right now. Thanks, everyone, for the encouragement, questions, and criticism. Daniel's response was particularly inspiring to me and deserves to be shared. The resistance of Israeli Jewish people to the occupation and the enormous risk taken by those refusing to serve in the Israeli military offers an example, especially for those of us living in the United States, of how to behave when you discover that atrocities are being committed in your name. Thank you. February 20th, 2003. Mama, now the Israeli army has actually dug up the road to Gaza and both of the major checkpoints are closed. This means that Palestinians who want to go and register for their next quarter at the university can't. People can't get to their jobs, and those who are trapped on the other side can't get home. And internationals who have a meeting tomorrow in the West Bank won't make it. We could probably make it through if we made serious use of our international white person privilege, but that would also mean some risk of arrest and deportation, even though none of us has done anything illegal. The Gaza Strip is divided in thirds now. There is some talk about the reoccupation of Gaza, but I seriously doubt this will happen because I think it would be a geopolitically stupid move for Israel right now. I think the more likely thing is an increase in smaller, below the international outcry, radar incursions, and possibly the off-hinted population transfer. I'm staying put in Rafah for now. No plans to head north. I still feel like I'm relatively safe and think that my most likely risk in case of a larger scale attack is arrest. A move to reoccupy Gaza would generate a much larger outcry than Sharon's assassination during peace negotiations and grab strategy, which is working very well now to create settlements all over, slowly but surely eliminating any meaningful possibility for Palestinian self-determination. Know that I have a lot of very nice Palestinians looking after me. I have a small flu bug and got some very nice lemony drinks to cure me. Also, the woman who keeps the key for the well where we still sleep keeps asking me about you. She doesn't speak a bit of English, but she asks about my mom pretty frequently. Wants to make sure I'm calling you. Love to you, and Dad, and Sarah, and Chris, and everybody. Rachel. February 27th, 2003. To her mother.
Love you. Really miss you. I have bad nightmares about tanks and bulldozers outside our house, and you and me inside. Sometimes the adrenaline acts as an anesthetic for weeks, and then in the evening or at night it just hits me again. A little bit of the reality of the situation. I am really scared for the people here. Yesterday, I watched a father lead his two tiny children holding his hands out into the sight of tanks with a sniper tower and bulldozers and jeeps because he thought his house was going to be exploded. Jenny and I stayed in the house with several women and two small babies. It was our mistake in translation that caused him to think it was his house that was being exploded. In fact, the Israeli army was in the process of detonating an explosive in the ground nearby, one that appears to have been planted by Palestinian resistance. This is in the area where Sunday, about 150 men were rounded up and contained outside the settlement with gunfire over their heads and around them, while tanks and bulldozers destroyed 25 greenhouses, the livelihoods for 300 people. The explosive was right in front of the greenhouses.
Right in the point of entry for tanks that might come in again. I was terrified to think that this man felt it was less of a risk to walk out in the view of tanks with his kids than to stay in his house. I was really scared that they were all going to be shot, and I tried to stand in the way of them in the tank. This happens every single day, but this father, walking out with his two little kids, just looking very sad, just happened to get my attention more at this particular moment, probably because I felt it was our translation problems that made him leave. I thought a lot about what you said on the phone about Palestinian violence not helping the situation. 60,000 workers from Rafah worked in Israel 2 years ago. Now only 600 can go to Israel for jobs. Of these 600, many have moved. Because the three checkpoints between here and Ashkelon, the closest city in Israel, make what used to be a 40-minute drive now a 12-hour or impossible journey. In addition, what Rafah identified in 1999 as sources of economic growth, are all completely destroyed. The Gaza International Airport, the runways are demolished, totally closed. The border for trade with Egypt, now with a giant Israeli sniper tower in the middle of the crossing. Access to the ocean, completely cut off in the last 2 years by a checkpoint and the Gush Katif settlement. The count of homes destroyed in Rafah since the beginning of this intifada is up around 600, by and large with no connection to the resistance, but who happen to live along the border. I think it is maybe official now that Rafah is the poorest place in the world. There used to be a middle class here, recently. We also get reports that in the past, Gazan flour shipments to Europe were delayed for 2 weeks at the Erez crossing for security inspections. You can imagine the value of two-week-old cut flowers in the European market. So that market dried up, and then the bulldozers came and took out people's vegetable farms and gardens.
What is left for the people? Tell me if you can think of anything. I can't. If any of us had our lives and welfare completely strangled, lived with children in a shrinking place where we knew, because of previous experience, that soldiers and tanks and bulldozers could come for us at any moment and destroy all the greenhouses that we had been cultivating for however long, and did this while some of us were beaten and held captive with 149 other people for several hours. Do you think we might try to use somewhat violent means to protect whatever fragments remained? I think about this especially when I see orchards and greenhouses and fruit trees destroyed. Just years of care and cultivation. I think about you and how long it takes to make things grow and what a labor of love it is. I really think, in a similar situation, most people would defend themselves as best as they could. I think Uncle Craig would. I think probably Grandma would. I think I would. You asked me about nonviolent resistance when the explosive detonated yesterday.
It broke all the windows in the family's house. I was in the process of being served tea and playing with two small babies. I'm having a hard time right now. Just feel sick to my stomach a lot from being doted on all the time, very sweetly, by people who are facing doom. I know that from the United States, it all sounds like hyperbole. Honestly, a lot of time, the sheer kindness of people here, coupled with the overwhelming evidence of the willful destruction of their lives, makes it seem unreal to me. I really can't believe that something like this can happen in the world without a bigger outcry about it. It really hurts me, again, like it has hurt me in the past, to witness how awful we can allow the world to be. I felt after talking to you that maybe you didn't completely believe me. I think it's actually good if you don't, because I do believe pretty much above all else in the importance of independent critical thinking, and I also realize that with you, I'm much less careful than usual about trying to source every assertion that I make. A lot of the reason for that is I know that you actually do go and do your own research, but it makes me worry about the job I'm doing, all this situation that I tried to enumerate above, and a lot of other things constitutes a somewhat gradual, often hidden but nevertheless massive removal and destruction of the ability of a particular group of people to survive. This is what I'm seeing here. The assassinations, rocket attacks, and shooting of children are atrocities. But in focusing on them, I'm terrified of missing their context. The vast majority of people here, even if they had the economic means to escape, even if they actually wanted to give up, resisting on their land and just leave, which appears to be maybe the less nefarious of Sharon's possible goals,
they can't leave. Because they can't even get into Israel to apply for visas, and because their destination countries won't let them in, both our country and Arab countries. So I think when all means of survival are cut off in a pen, Gaza, which people can't get out of, I think that qualifies as genocide. Even if they could get out, I think it would still qualify as genocide. Maybe you could look up the definition of genocide according to international law. I don't remember it right now. I'm going to get better at illustrating this, hopefully. I don't like to use those charged words. I think you know this about me. I really value words. I really try to illustrate and let people draw their own conclusions. Anyway, I'm rambling. Just want to write to my mom and tell her that I'm witnessing this chronic tragedy, insidious genocide, and I'm really scared and questioning my fundamental belief in goodness of human nature. This has to stop. I think it is a good idea for us all to drop everything and devote our lives to making this stop. I don't think this is an extremist thing to do anymore. I still really want to dance around to Pat Benatar and have boyfriends and make comics for my coworkers, but I also want this to stop. Disbelief and horror is what I feel. Disappointment.
I am disappointed that this is the base of reality of our world and that we, in fact, participate in it. This is not at all what I asked for when I came into this world. This is not at all what the people here asked for when they came into this world. This is not the world you and Dad wanted me to come into when you decided to have me. This is not what I meant when I looked at the Capitol Lake and said, "This is the wide world and I'm coming to it." I did not mean that I was coming into a world where I could live a comfortable life and possibly, with no effort at all, exist in complete unawareness of my participation in genocide. More big explosions somewhere in the distance outside. When I came back from Palestine, I probably will have nightmares and constantly feel guilty for not being here, but I can channel that into more work. Coming here is one of the better things I've ever done, so when I sound crazy or if the Israeli military should break with their racist tendency not to injure white people, please pin the reason squarely on the fact that I am in the midst of genocide, which I am also indirectly supporting and for which my government is largely responsible. I love you, Dad. I love you and Dad. Sorry for the diatribe. Okay, some strange men next to me just gave me some peas, so I need to eat and thank them. Rachel, February 28th, 2003, to her mother.
Thanks, Mom, for your responses to my email. It really helps me to get word from you and from other people who care about me. After I wrote to you, I went incommunicado about the affinity group for about 10 hours, which I spent with a family on the front line in Hayy Salaam, who fixed me dinner and have cable TV. The two front rooms of their house are unusable because gunshots have been fired through the walls. So the whole family, three kids and two parents, sleep in the parents' bedroom. I sleep on the floor next to the youngest daughter, Iman, and we all share the blankets. I helped the son with his English homework a little, and we all watched Pet Sematary, which is a horrifying movie. I think they all thought it was pretty funny how much trouble I had watching it. Friday is the holiday, and when I woke up, they were watching Gummy Bears dubbed in Arabic. So I ate breakfast with them and sat there for a while and just enjoyed being in this big puddle of blankets with this family, watching what for me seemed like Saturday morning cartoons. Then I walked some way to Brazil, which is where Nidal and Mansour and grandmother and Rafat and all the rest of the big family that has really wholeheartedly adopted me live. The other day, by the way, grandmother gave me a pantomimed lecture in Arabic that involved a lot of blowing and pointing to her black shawl. I got Nidal to tell her that my mother would appreciate knowing that someone here was giving me a lecture about smoking turning my lungs black. I met their sister-in-law, who's visiting from the Nusayrat camp, and played with her small baby. Nidal's English gets better every day. He's the one who calls me.
My sister. He started teaching grandmother how to say, "Hello, how are you?" in English. You can always hear the tanks and bulldozers passing by, but all of these people are genuinely cheerful with each other and with me. When I am with Palestinian friends, I tend to be somewhat less horrified than when I'm trying to act in a role of human rights observer, documenter, or direct action resister. They are a good example of how to be in it for the long haul. I know that the situation gets to them and may ultimately get to them on all kinds of levels, but I am nevertheless amazed at their strength in being able to defend such a large degree of their humanity, laughter, generosity, family time, against the incredible horror occurring in their lives and against the constant presence of death. I felt much better after this morning. I spent a lot of time writing about the disappointment of discovering somewhat firsthand the degree of evil which we are still capable. I should at least mention that I am also discovering a degree of strength and a basic ability for humans to remain human in the direct of circumstances, which I also haven't seen before. I think the word is dignity. I wish you could meet these people. Maybe, hopefully, someday you will.
I think I could see a Palestinian state or a democratic Israeli-Palestinian state within my lifetime. I think freedom for Palestine could be an incredible source of hope to people struggling all over the world. I think it could also be an incredible inspiration to Arab people in the Middle East who are struggling under undemocratic regimes with the U.S., which the U.S. supports. I look forward to increasing numbers of middle-class privileged people like you and me becoming aware of the structures that support our privileges and beginning to support the work of those who aren't privileged to dismantle those structures. I look forward to more moments like February 15th when civil society wakes up from en masse and issues massive and resonant evidence of its conscience, its willingness to be repressed, unwillingness to be repressed, and its compassion for the suffering of others.
I look forward to more teachers emerging like Matt Grant and Barbara Weaver and Dale Knuth, who teach critical thinking to the kids in the United States. I look forward to the international resistance that's occurring now, fertilizing analysis on all kinds of issues with dialogue between diverse groups of people. I look forward to all of us who are new at the developing better skills for working in democratic structures and healing our own racism and classism and sexism and heterosexism and ageism and ableism and becoming more effective. One other thing. I think this is a lot about public protest, like the one a few weeks ago here that was attended by only about 150 people. Whenever I organize or participate in public protest, I get really worried that it will just suck, be really, really small, embarrassing, and the media will laugh at me. Oftentimes, it is really small, and most of the time, the media laughs at me. The weekend after our 150% person protest, we were invited to a maybe 2,000-person protest. Even though we had a small protest, and of course, it didn't get coverage all over the world, in some places, the word Rafah was mentioned outside of the Arab press. Colin got a sign in English, in Arabic, into the protest in Seattle that said, "Olympia says no to war on Rafah and Iraq." His pictures went up on the Rafah Today website that a guy named Muhammad here runs. People here and elsewhere saw those pictures.
I think about Glenn going out every Friday for 10 years with tag board signs that address the number of children dead from sanctions in Iraq. Sometimes just one or two people there and everyone thought they were crazy and they got spit upon. Now there are a lot more people on Friday evenings. The juncture between 4th and State is just lined with them and they get a lot of honks and waves and thumbs up. They created an infrastructure there for other people to do something. Getting spit on, that made it easier for someone else to decide that they could write a letter to the editor, or stand at the back of the rally, or do something that seems slightly less ridiculous than standing at the side of the road addressing the deaths of the children in Iraq and getting spit on. Just hearing about what you are doing makes me feel less alone, less useless, less invisible. Those honks and waves help. The pictures help. Colin helps. The international media and our government are not going to tell us that we are effective, important, justified in our work, courageous, intelligent, valuable. We have to do that for each other. And one way we can do that is by continuing our work
visibly. I also think it's important for people in the United States in relative privilege to realize that people without privilege will be doing this work no matter what, because they are working for their lives. We can work with them, and they can know that we work with them, or we can leave them to do this work themselves and curse us for our complicity in killing them. I really don't get the same sense that anyone here curses us. I also get the sense that people here in particular are actually more concerned in the immediate about our comfort and health, and that they are about us risking our lives on their behalf. At least that's the case for me. People try to give me a lot of tea and food in the midst of gunfire and explosive detonation. I love you, Rachel.
Rachel's last email. Hi, Papa. Thank you for your email. I feel like sometimes I spend all my time propagandizing Mom and assuming she'll pass stuff on to you so you get neglected. Don't worry about me too much. Right now I am most concerned that we are not being effective. I still don't feel particularly at risk. Rafah has seemed calmer lately, maybe because the military is preoccupied with incursions in the north, still shooting and house demolitions. one death this week that I know of, but not any larger incursions. Still can't say how this will change if and when war with Iraq comes. Thanks also for stepping up your anti-war work. I know it's not easy to do and probably much more difficult where you are than where I am. I'm really interested in talking to the journalist in Charlotte. Let me know what I can do to speed the process along. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I leave here and when I'm going to leave. Right now, I think I could stay until June financially. I really don't want to come back to Olympia, but do need to go back there to clean my stuff out of the garage and talk about my experiences here. On the other hand, now that I've crossed the ocean, I'm feeling a strong desire to try to stay across the ocean for some time. Considering trying to get English teaching jobs, we'd like to really buckle down and learn Arabic. Also got an invitation to visit Sweden on my way back, which I think I could do very cheaply. I would like to leave Rafa with a viable plan to return, too. One of the core members of our group has to leave tomorrow, and watching her say goodbye to people is making me realize how difficult it will be. People here can't leave, so that complicates things. They also are pretty matter-of-fact about the fact that they don't know if they will be alive when we come back here. I really don't want to live with a lot of guilt about this place, being able to come and go so easily and not going back. I think it's valuable to make commitments to places, so I'd like to be able to plan on coming back here within a few years or so. Of all these possibilities, I think it's most likely that I will at least go to Sweden for a few weeks on my way back. I can change tickets and get a plane from Paris to Sweden and back for a total of around $150 or so. I know I should really try to link up with the family in France, but I really think that I'm not going to do that. I think I would just be angry the whole time and not much fun to be around. It also seems like a transition into too much opulence right now. I would feel a lot of class guilt the whole time as well. Let me know if you have any ideas about what I should do with the rest of my life. I love you very much. If you want, you can write to me as if I was on vacation at a camp on the Big Island of Hawaii. Learning to weave. One thing I do to make things easier here is to utterly retreat into fantasies that I am in a Hollywood movie or sitcom starring Michael J. Fox. So feel free to make something up, and I'll be happy to play along. Much love, Poppy. Rachel.
Thank you so much for having us here tonight. Thank you to all of you. That was a remarkable gift to us. We've of course read the emails many times and have read a bit from them, but it was a remarkable gift to have them all read to us. I can't tell you how much that means. Khalil Gibran wrote, "When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight." Someone, I don't know who it was, left this quote scrawled on a scrap of paper for our family just 1 week after Rachel was killed. It is just one of the many kindnesses shown to us by one of the many people who continue to reach out to us with love and support and inspiration. It is surprising to me sometimes to find that at a low moment, that moment can be turned to something brighter with a few beautiful, potent words, with a poem, a song, with a glance at an olive wood angel carved in Bethlehem. It is a reminder to me that though to be human, we must feel the depth of our losses, that we can also choose optimistic, healing responses to loss. we have in these past 5 months become very aware of the loving human family of which we are all a part. People spread across the globe who are filled with goodness and compassion, and who, when others are hurting, reach out. It reminds me that in the words of Donne, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. We are immensely grateful to all of you here in Houston who have taken time from your busy lives to come and share time with us and to remember Rachel, to learn more about her and about the things that mattered to her. I'd like to especially thank the Nugent family for hosting us. Brandy Morgan, I don't know if she's here right now, but for taking care of us since we've arrived. Brandy. I'd like to especially thank Janice Blue and KPFT and People for Progressive Radio, who have worked so imaginatively to create this space of a few days here in Houston for the community and for Craig and me to reflect upon Rachel and upon her experience in Palestine. When I first talked with Janice, it was immediately clear to me that she was someone with great warmth and openness and an amazing amount of creative energy directed at making this world a healthier place. I found myself listening to her over the phone and wanting immediately to say, yes, we will come to Houston, not just because of what we could bring and give to you, but because of what you could give to us, and that's already happening this evening. I should point out that as we approach the five-month anniversary of Rachel's killing, our lives remain very confused. There is no quick or sure way that I know of to sort out one's life after the impact of an event like this. So we continue to move day by day and to trust that by sharing Rachel's story and by participating in the dialogue on the Israeli-Palestine conflict and the U.S. role in that conflict, that we continue Rachel's work and that hopefully we bring the day a bit closer when there will be no more killings in Israel and Palestine, a day when there will be a just peace for all the people of that region. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight. That Khalil Gibran quote, "The gift left scrawled on a scrap of paper," has become a mantra of sorts to me, an invitation when I am sad to reach into my memory, into the memories of others who knew and spent time with Rachel, into letters and journals, into the photograph albums, and to spend time with her, recalling the beautiful, unique, loving, playful human being who was my daughter. It is difficult to summarize a life. There were many dimensions to Rachel, as there are to each of us, and in her too short time walking this earth, she still managed to think about many things, to experience many things, to be many things. Tonight, Craig and I want to share a bit of Rachel's history and thought, and hope that by doing so, we can give you a fuller sense of who she was and of the spirit that led her to Palestine. If Rachel were here listening, I know that she would challenge us. She might say that we were creating myths or that we had gotten something truly wrong. She would, without a doubt, tell us not to idealize her. She would insist that the attention be not on her, but on all the others who continue to suffer and die in both Palestine and Israel, and even more on those who remain and continue to courageously and creatively work for nonviolent and just solutions to this tragic problem. So while not forgetting those for whom she went to Gaza, let me tell you a little about Rachel herself. From the moment of her birth, She was an essential part of us, her mom, her dad, her older brother and sister. So much of what we miss now, of course, is just having her around. Coming through the door to our house into the safety of a family place where she could just be. She napped on our couches. She relaxed on our deck, bathing herself in welcome spring sunshine, which followed the damp gray western Washington winters. She ate potato soup suppers with us and sat in front of the stove in our living room to warm herself. She curled up in quiet corners to write and made messes creating art in the garage. She asked me for advice about how to grow plants and wandered through the yard exploring the life that was emerging there. She talked me into taking her out for sushi dinners and identified for me every variety of fish we were sharing together. When she came to visit in North Carolina after Craig and I had moved there, we hiked together along the Catawba River, poked our way through a few antique shops until she found a Cuban cigar tin that would serve as her purse, and went on a shopping excursion to Goodwill for some additions to her wardrobe because she had grown very uncomfortable with shopping malls. The words were important to both of us, and we talked often. We had a way of knowing about each other that required no words. In our family, she challenged our political views when they needed challenging. She chastised us a bit if she felt we were not thoughtful enough in our opinions. She playfully teased us about our shortcomings and worried far too much about her own. She loved us and comforted us and supported us when we needed it. When she had not seen us for a time, she greeted us with long, loving embraces. Rachel was born in Olympia, Washington, April 10, 1979. She grew up and also spent her four last months in the U.S. at our family home on a two-acre plot of land along a creek which flows out of the nearby Black Hills and into Puget Sound. At high tide, brackish water comes pouring into the bay below our house. But at low tide, it retreats, leaving mud flats where through the years Rachel and her friends loved to play and where they would cover themselves in mud and occasionally lose shoes and toys. As a small child, she would scamper among the trillium blooming in the woods, would play in the tree forts that her older sister and brother had built, dabble in rivulets of water at the creek, sometimes talk to the ducks, or hide in the grasses that erupted in the stream bed each spring. Her grandmother writes of her as an infant, Rachel would lie with Chris and Sarah stretched on the floor beside her playing a board game. Games bored me, but here this baby seemed entranced. I think it was her feeling of connectedness, a belonging, that person-to-person relatedness that was so remarkable to her. Rachel's life didn't touch yours lightly. She impacted you. Rachel's school days began at a preschool in a little cabin in the woods on the beach of Puget Sound. She and her little friends, most of whom became lifelong friends and whose mothers I still walk with, investigated barnacles, mussels, seaweed, and sand crabs. Maybe it was here that her love of found objects originated. It was certainly here and in our own yard filled with blackberries, Oregon grape, firs, and cedars that her love of the natural world was nurtured. There were animals in Rachel's life, chickens, rabbits, cats, and dogs. She would lovingly hold and pat her pet hen and for a time her best friend, Brownie. And she had numerous kitties that cuddled with her in bed, kitties that inspired some of her earliest poetry and storytelling. Elementary school was in the Options Program, a public school alternative that emphasized making connections with the community and the world. As a fifth grader, she and her classmates took a week-long field trip around the Olympic Peninsula. She slept on a gymnasium floor in the Makah Indian community, walked in the Ho Rainforest, and investigated her own 4-by-4-inch square of earth to discover all the life that she could find in it. That year, too, she participated in a press conference on world hunger, and she wrote her ambitions in her fifth grade yearbook. I want to be a lawyer, a dancer, an actress, a mother, a wife, a children's author, a distance runner, a poet, a pianist, a pet store owner, an astronaut, an environmental and humanitarian activist, a psychiatrist, a ballet teacher, and the first woman president. But there was the 20-year-old Rachel who remembered that list and wrote to her grandmother, "Do you know that in a lot of pre-literate societies, people were given names that delineated their roles, like Joe Fence Builder or Bob Tiger Hunter, and they just identified completely with their job and did it well? Sometimes I think I'd be much more productive if my name was Rachel Soup Maker, and all I had to do was make the tastiest darn soups ever for my village. I wouldn't spend so much time racing back and forth between creative writing and teaching and journalism and psychology and film and sociology and ecology and ethnobotany and international relations, and the list goes on and on and on. I remember when I graduated fifth grade, we had a list of questions for our yearbook. One of them was, what do you want to be when you grow up? Everyone wrote something like doctor or astronaut or Spider-Man. And then you turn the page, and there was my five-paragraph manifesto on the million things I wanted to be, from wandering poet to first woman president. That was real cute in fifth grade, but when it's 10 years later, I'm going to be a junior in college, and I still don't have the conviction to cross Spider-Man off my list. Well, you can imagine it gets a little nerve-wracking. Rachel's high school years were shared with our exchange students, Gustavo from Brazil, Anyuta from Russia, and Saiko from Japan. Then as a sophomore, Rachel made her own trip with a teacher and four other students to Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk in the Sakhalin Islands of Russia. Here she stayed with a Russian family for 6 weeks, and her view of the world and her life were never the same. She saw firsthand the hardships that the Russian people were facing, and her privilege as an American youth became all too real to her. She spent a lot of time with her teachers, talking, sorting things out. One of them wrote about her, "When I consider Rachel's impact on me, the first phrase that occurs is destined to make a difference. In my relationship with Rachel as her teacher and friend, there was a mutual respect for the written word. She was the creator, I was the editor. I was a sounding board for Rachel. She had so many ideas, so many questions. Discussing societal values and beliefs through the literary works we studied gave all of us the opportunity to explore what is most significant." Rachel moved on to the Evergreen State College just miles from our home, but she eventually became uncomfortable being just a student. She took 1 year and worked in the Washington State Conservation Corps. She made trails in the Olympic Forest, cleared campgrounds at Mount Rainier, learned to be a flagger on mountain roads, insisted that she be allowed to operate the chainsaw, as were her male counterparts, and one day carried in her lap a moose head that needed a trip to the taxidermist for refurbishing before Mount Rainier National Park's 50th birthday party. For 3 years, Rachel worked for Behavioral Health Resources at Hospital Diversion House, where mental health clients resided as they changed medications or transitioned to their homes. She made home visits and created a weekly drop-in session, which filled a need for social interaction for some of the clients. She advocated for funds for art supplies and a rented van in order to take the drop-in group on outings. All of her work was confidential, but after her death, some of her clients, some who often had difficulty being with other people or even speaking, began to talk publicly in the Olympia community of the impact Rachel had on their lives. She was clearly their friend. Rachel somehow created balance between her school and work life. Evergreen offers a curriculum that focuses on problems, themes, and experiences in the world. It is about connections, and Rachel made these between school, work, her community, and later with Palestine. One of her faculty wrote, "In the beginning, she was quiet, an intense observer, a passionate witness who saw deeply into the possibilities. I first got to know Rachel through her writings, writings which put me on high alert, that kept me up late at night with their intensity, beauty, determination, and humor. Rachel was searching, always searching, and open to the unexpected. She appreciated things that were not always apparent to others. She cared very much about other students, and they became devoted friends. With them, she helped to make things possible. In June of last year, Rachel wrote, "Studying the history of this area roots me. It makes me more conscious of myself and of people around me as actors in history. We are startled to discover that the places that we live in are important. History is motivating. We've certainly waded in the same water and wandered on the same beaches as very brave people. It makes bravery seem possible." So it was from this foundation that Rachel emerged and eventually made her way to Palestine. She told us that going to Gaza was one of the most important things she had done in her life. With other activists, she spent nights sleeping at wells in Rafah to protect them from demolition. She stood between Palestinian municipal water workers who were trying to repair wells and the Israeli military towers from which shots rang down, harassing the workers and the internationals. She documented the destruction of Palestinian olive orchards, gardens, and greenhouses, as well as harassment of Palestinians at checkpoints. She learned Arabic from Palestinian children and helped them with their English homework. She drank sweet tea with Palestinian grandmothers, held wiggling babies, and danced with children in the street. In June of last year, Rachel wrote of her own community, Olympia, "I look at this place now and I just want to do right by it. The salmon beneath downtown and the people who come to drop-ins group and the creeks and the inlets and the people who were here first and my elementary school teachers and my mom." At a celebration for Rachel's life, her Evergreen faculty concluded, "Rachel left this place, which she embraced with both care and impatience, and went to another place that she had been carefully learning about, Gaza, to make the community-to-community connections that she valued so much and was so good at. As Rachel said, she just wanted to do right by it." In the last journal that she filled before departing for Gaza, there is a page where Rachel is clearly brainstorming her values. I would like to close by sharing that page with you. "My values, my values, my values. I value respect for other human beings. Responsibility for myself, accountability. Love. Trust other people. Believe others are doing the best they can with the resources they have. Independence, autonomy, creativity, ethical inside, forgiveness, honesty, humor, integrity, courage, loyalty, critical thinking, curiosity, celebrating people, community, family. Keep myself safe, protect my core. Equity, justice, fairness." Yes, Rachel, you are your mother's delight and also my inspiration. Thank you.